Lord, we thank you for your love. We thank you for the fact of the incarnation, the Christmas season, the fact that you didn't leave us in the dark as to what you were like and what your heart was like, and your goodwill for us, your well wishes for us, and your aggressive grace that broke into our history to come get us. We thank you for tonight, a chance to reflect upon the awesomeness of this, and pray that you would help us understand it and learn and grow in our knowledge of you, and bless our time together for your purpose, and that we might fall more in love with your Son. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, well, we have 3 weeks to cover about 10 weeks worth of material, as far as I can tell. But I put most of it in the syllabus, so that's the good news. And we're going to start literally in your binder. You should have an inside pocket that's got maps, a map, and then a family tree of Jesus' his closest family members, which we'll talk about later in the session. We'll go through who some of the heroes of the early church were, and his uncle Clopas, and we'll talk about how his descendants of Joseph and Mary dominated the Galilean church, the church in northern Israel, for the first couple of centuries. And they were outstanding. We'll talk about them obliquely in the session. But you'll also have a map. But we'll start with page one. And of course, we won't actually start with page one, because I've got to go do that cover background before we get to page one. Because page one starts with the exile to Babylonia. And that's where Israel gets carried off to Babylon. So I've got to cover... that happens in 522 B.C. or 586 or something like that. So there's an additional 2,500 years prior to that that I have to cover and review. So the way this works is I drew a map and ruined my whiteboard by using a permanent marker as opposed to a dry erase marker. So get it once, because we won't be able to cover this again. So this is a really bad picture of the ancient Near East. And so this is the Mediterranean Sea. And this is basically Israel. Today's modern state of Israel is like here. That's not drawn a scale, obviously. This is Egypt down here. This is the Suez Canal, the strait there. This is the Arabian Peninsula down here. This is the Tigris-Euphrates River, which runs through Iraq up into through Syria and into Turkey. So this is just the modern ancient Near East. In the ancient world, this was called the Fertile Crescent. And this is not drawn to scale. The Fertile Crescent was a crescent that ran... You know, in school, when we learned history, it runs like that. And you can see it runs along the water, basically, the water courses. And so all the vegetation in the ancient Near East runs there until they discover irrigation. Okay? So that's the Fertile Crescent that we know of. And for us, biblical history begins at the time of Abraham. So Abraham, who's the father of the Jews and the Muslims, of all the monotheistic religions, he's actually the father of many nations, as God promised him. He actually, when in Genesis, it picks up, he is down here in Ur of the Chaldees. So he's living over in Babylon at the time, about probably 2500 B.C., somewhere in that neck of the woods, 2500 to 2000 B.C. And God tells him to leave his kinfolk and to go into a land that he's going to promise him. And so Abraham, he's called Abram at the time. Abram, his father and his grandfather, and their brood. He has a wife and Lot is his nephew. And there's a whole passel of folk, about 150 folk, householders, everything. They start moving up the Tigris-Euphrates River to go in here because you wouldn't cut across the desert. You just don't do that. And so all the trade routes and the international trade routes went this way. So they went up here. When they get up about north here, the father and the grandfather stay there, and the uncles. Most of everybody else stays there where Syria is today, in a place called Padam Aram. And the kinfolk settle there, and then Abraham continues his journey down into the promised land alone with his wife Sarah, and his butlers and servants and things of this type. They go into there. Eventually, of course, he will have a kid, and the kid will have a kid, Isaac and Jacob, and then they will go back here, by the way, to get wives. Where this is where Rebecca and Rachel will be, was where the household was stiff. They left them there. And so they're kinfolk, and that's how they go find kinfolk, since there's no kinfolk in the land, for them to marry. Okay, so Abram comes into the land, gets really discouraged about God keeping his promises, about giving him an heir, and he adopts a couple of expedients to try to get there his own way. And eventually God gives him the promised son Isaac. And so Abraham's family grows. So there's Abraham, Isaac, then Jacob. Jacob gives birth to the 12 children of Israel. So the 12 sons of Israel are born there in the land. Everybody's in that land. They're all just sort of living around. They're shepherds. You know, they're very powerful. He's got a very strong army. He defeats five kings with his household. There's lots of good stories in there. There's a famous biblical figure called Melchizedek, who was the king priest of pre-Jerusalem, Jerusalem. And in my opinion, Melchizedek leads Abram to the Lord, basically introduces him to, puts together what Abram knows with what Melchizedek knows from history of knowing God. And Abram then makes all his commitments to the Lord, and God blesses him. And so the family grows up there. Then we have that dramatic production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, right? And the other 11 brothers sell Joseph into slavery into Egypt. And so Joseph gets sold in. There's a huge slave trade that goes through here. Huge slave trade. He shows up in Egypt. We have that famous story of, you know, the 7 years of plenty and the 7 years of scant, of want, and basically at that particular point, all of the Israelites migrate down to Egypt. And so when we start the book of Exodus, all of Israel now has left the promised land. They know where God has promised them, but he said not yet. And so they're now down in Egypt as the book of Exodus starts. And remember, Joseph was real, real high power. He's like third highest position power under Pharaoh in Egypt. And then we get the story of the massacre of the children, you know, the midwives. You get the Passover story, basically. So the Egyptian king at that particular time, the Pharaoh at that particular time, is under tremendous international pressures from battles and marauders, forces that are trying to take over from up in this area. He's very concerned. These are all Asiatics, they call them, people from this land that were called from this type of Asia. He was scared to death that the internal Israelites, who are also Asiatics, but they're his slaves at this particular point, that they will rise up in the middle of the warfare and hit them from behind. So needless to say, he's got to subject them, and that's how they do, you know, put them in under even more harsh servitude. They were doing okay for about 300-400 years until a new king arose that knew not Joseph. And he's the one that's afraid of all this stuff, so that I got to reel these people in, because if they turn on me in battle, I have no hope. And they were very, very powerful. And so we have the story of Exodus, where God confronted, the God of Israel confronted the God of Egypt, who was the Pharaoh. Pharaoh was the God. He was the incarnation of the sun god. Okay, and so there's a battle of the gods, and Yahweh wins. And it's interesting that we have the story, Israel's story in the Bible of how that happened and why they left. You know, that whole story of Exodus 1 through about, 18 or so, 14 or so, that leaving. But there's also an Egyptian record by an Egyptian historian. Now you think about it, so you're an official writer, you do press releases for the White House. Okay, it's your job to spin this, this mass overthrowing and the loss of all your free labor force out. And so the story that the Egyptians came up with is that the Israelites were expelled because they were all lepers. So they had all these horrible diseases, and so Barosus and Manetho, the ancient Egyptian historian, says that they were all just kicked out, and they were all 1.4 million of them apparently had leprosy. So it's just an interesting way of spinning stuff. So they leave. We get the 40 years wandering in the wilderness, with all the people, and then they come up into the land. They don't go up in directly, but they come in around the side here. This is the Sea of the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee, which we'll look at in a few more minutes. But much smaller than this, actually. But then they come up and they go around the Dead Sea, and then they're going to come right in here at Jericho. And Jericho, where it is today, is right there across the Jordan River at the northernmost tip of the Dead Sea. And that's where we have that Joshua, Battle of Jericho, remember that thing, where they fight there and the walls come tumbling down. And then Israel goes into the land and they conquer basically the northern part of the country and the southern part of the country. And that takes, 20 years. They don't conquer it all. They get just enough, and then they relax obedience. They get out of trouble, and then they stop obeying, and that's going to rise up and haunt them. There are things that unfinished business, they leave there. They don't deal with it. And so they go in. The book of Joshua is about the conquest, and basically, God had told Abraham that in 400 odd years, I'm going to evict their current tenants of this land. They're going to get so bad in the way they treat one another and what they do that I'm actually just going to evict them. But they're not there yet. I haven't given them their 30-day notice. And he ends up giving them about 400 years notice, because of the way that all of the prophecies that he was going to give the land to Abraham would have been recorded locally. That's the way prophecies were. There was always a shrine. There was a priest. It was always written down. All of these prophecies were public disclosure. When God told the patriarch ahead of time that the older shall serve the younger. There's no mystery about it. That's not a secret. That's written down and recorded on a clay tablet in a shrine somewhere. You always recorded messages from God. And the public could go in there and inspect those easily. So there was no question but that, that everybody over here knew that, time was limited, and so there was a mass exodus of people out of the land as Israel comes into that, which is a certain number. They were the smart ones that left. And so Joshua, they more or less conquer enough of the land, and then they relax. And Judges is the most horrible book in the Bible. It's just where it says like 3 or 4 times that every man did what was right in his own eyes. He just did what he felt like. You know, they didn't obey the Lord. They didn't follow any directions, any pleadings of the prophets that God sent them. And so they were always in trouble, and God was always posting bail for them and getting them out of trouble and stuff like this. And so there was a huge issue there. And then at the end of Judges, they said that we need a king like all the other countries around us. And this is not working, and so we want a king so we can feel proud and have all this national pride. If the alternative is to trust God and live without government, without taxes, without the draft and things of this type, if that's the choice, or to not trust God and have all those things, a king that needs to be supported, he's going to take our lands, he's going to tax us, the best of our kids, he's going to haul off his bakers and cooks and stuff like this. If that's the choice, surely I'll take the one that's the most punitive and most expensive. And that's what they do. They decide for a king. And so we have the first three kings. We have Saul, that was picked. And then Saul, God gives Saul a shot at it. And Saul blows it more than one time and more than gross ways. And then he picks David, and then after David comes Solomon. Well, Solomon is the high water mark of the ancient Israel world. They've got as far over here as the Tigris and Euphrates. Babylon is not really a vassal state, but they have almost like a forced alliance. I mean, they're that powerful that you have to do business with them. And all the nations around them are basically, vassal states. So they would be like tributes. They would have taxes in return for protection. They'd get military protection, on the other side against the people out here. But that was a high water mark under Solomon. Solomon, of course, made all the political alliances with the nations around him, built the false temples of false gods, had a divided mind about the Lord, and God says, then I will divide your kingdom. You're going to be divided by me, I'm going to divide you. And so they break Israel into two parts. We get the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And the northern kingdom is known as Israel, and the southern kingdom is known as Judah, right? And Judah is actually two tribes, but the ten tribes are north, Israel and Judah. And Israel, of course, doesn't have Jerusalem. We've got a counterfeit religion up there cooking up. And Israel gets conquered by the Assyrians that come down in 722 B.C. So in 722 B.C., the northern kingdom gets hauled off and scattered around the world. Okay, that leaves only little Judah, from which we get the word Jew. We call a person a Jew today. The Jews, that comes from the word Judah. Okay, they're still there. We got every third king is a good one. Every third or fourth king is a good one. Whips everybody back into a frenzy about worshiping the Lord. They have great revivals, and it's like a grass fire. The next week, they're back to usual. It's just nothing, not much left there. We were all doing well until Monday, and then the nasty here and now, sabotage the sweet by, And so they do. God is exceptionally patient with these people. The good news about the fact that he was patient with them is that we get all the major prophets. So Isaiah, Jeremiah, all these sweet messages about a future Redeemer that we talk about at Christmas are given during this period. Most of it is from that period of 722 to 586. That in that 150-year period, roughly, is where we get the prophecies, where we get Handel's Bible. We get that in this particular period of time. So at around 586, 587, God says, okay, you're doing worse than the previous tenants were. And I told you that if you did the same they would do, I would evict you too. I am no respecter of persons. I don't, just because I like you doesn't mean you can do wrong, especially wronger than the other people. I am fair, and I have been very generous and gracious and patient with you all these centuries, but enough's enough. So it's time to go to the woodshed. So 586, they get hauled off to Babylon. And in Babylon, they learn a couple of very important lessons. And it's there that our actual outline, I think, starts. Okay, well, in exile to Babylon, that's the wrong date, actually. How about that? 722 was the exile of the northern kingdom, right? So the southern kingdom is exiles 586, 587, roughly, B.C. Okay? Now, in Babylon, Babylon, of course, is Babylon has conquered Assyria. Remember, Assyria was the one who conquered the northern part, right? Assyria. And Babylon just grew in power, and it finally conquered Assyria. And so that's why it was Babylon that hauled off the southern kingdom, as opposed to Assyria that conquered the northern kingdom. So they're over in Babylon. While they're in Babylon, that second bullet, Babylonia falls to Persia. So Cyrus II the Great conquers, the Persian king comes in 539 B.C., so Israel's been in there some 40-odd years, 50 years, something of that type. They conquer Babylon. Babylon falls. Then the next bullet, repatriation of the exiles begins, and the decree to restore the temple. What happens, Persia had the policy. Remember, Assyria, when they conquered you, they took you and dispersed you all over the world so you couldn't arise as a nation again. See, so they would just scatter you, destroy your kinship groups, things of this type, so you could never, you know, have a national pride enough that would attack them. Babylon would deport you in mass just to one place. You could still produce taxes. You know, you could still keep your friendship ties and stuff of this type. But and generally, they would not let you do your religion. They let the Jews do the religion for odd reasons, but they let them do it. When you get Persia, however, Persia came in and said, no, we're going to actually ask all the people to do their religion as long as they also sacrifice to the king and his sons. And so when the Persians take over, they had a history of they would repatriate a people. They would send them back to their land, support them, let them build their temples, and that's exactly what we have in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah and Ezra. Okay, that the decree to restore Jerusalem, build a temple, occurs in this time frame. So Ezra and Nehemiah, you know, they go and there's a second temple. It's called the Zerubbabel Temple. Is built. It's nothing like the magnet. Grandeur of Solomon's temple. You know, it's a very humble one. The old people that saw the second one, as they saw the second one, that remember the first, it says they wept that it was built. And we don't know when they wept because it was such a poor copy thereof, out of just humiliation and the shame of it all. Or they wept just because the temple had been rebuilt. It could have been a good or bad, or a mixture of both. Okay, so they come back into the land, and then we have the battle between Alexander fights Persia. So in one of the longest campaigns, most impressive military campaigns of history, is the fight between Persia, Darius, and the Greeks, Alexander. And they make all kind of movies out of these people. And of course, Greece is up here. Persia has got all of this, you know, Persia's got all of this land basically over here, all the way to here. Alexander is coming from Macedonia up here in Greece, a little bit off the scale. And one of the things they do is they march first and conquer Persia, and then they come back through and they conquer all the rest of this. So they've got two or three different things that Alexander the Great. Now, Alexander the Great was, of course, a very brilliant military strategist. He had a great leadership ability with his people. People loved him. He died very, very young. All kinds of speculation as to what kind of things killed him. We know he was a big, heavy drinker, but there's all kinds of speculation as to what kinds of things did him in. But there's an interesting story here in the book of Daniel. And remember, Daniel, and we will come back to Daniel when we talk about the Magi, about what we call as the wise men. The Magi were astrologers from Babylon. And Babylon had always been famous for studying the stars. I have literally textbooks of ancient Babylonian astronomy, how to read the stars and what these omens and portents meant and things of this type. They've been doing this from the day one. I mean, they were really, really good at this. Anytime something weird happened, they were all over. When Hezekiah, one of the good kings here, the prophet Isaiah went to Hezekiah and said, put your house in order, you're about to die. God says you're about to die. And Hezekiah's not happy about this. And so he pleads to the Lord and says, hey, this is right. I've been doing this really good stuff here. You know, don't cut the program off in the middle of things. Think of all the good. You know, he makes his little pitch to the Lord, you know. And before Isaiah, this is the Lord. Before Isaiah has even left the palace courtyard, God sends Isaiah back to him and says, okay, I'll give you 10 more years. You can see the prophet gets the scriptures. Look, it doesn't do any good for me to deliver a message of judgment. You know, I get halfway across the country, and God's going to, soften his heart and let the guy off. You know, Jonah was, remember, that was Jonah's problem with the Nineveh. He told Jonah, I said, go preach to Nineveh, tell him 3 days, and Nineveh will be destroyed. And Jonah ran from the Lord. Remember, he saw that fish story, where he takes shipping away and gets thrown overboard. And then he goes and he walks through Nineveh, Syria. We're talking Syria. They're really going to be really bad after Jonah. And he pronounces this judgment and he goes up to a hill to watch God, wipe these people off the face of the earth. These hated Gentile Assyrian people, And everybody from the king down, repents. They have a change of heart about this thing, man. That they stopped doing oppression. They had this revival, to show the sincerity, one of the things you did back in the Old Testament is that you would change your clothes from your festive garb, you'd put on sackcloth. It's like that rough old book. It's like burlap. It feels like burlap to show, that you weren't into pleasure. You were sort of self-mortification. You'd do dust like they do on, Ash Wednesday. Those kinds of things, like repent in sackcloth and ashes was his phrase. And the king, everybody from the king on down, they did the sackcloth, and they also put sackcloth on the cattle. You show how serious they were. They put sackcloth on the cows. I'm sure the cows are thinking, what is this? I've seen little dog sweaters, but, they have sackcloth for the cows. So you have this, So God doesn't destroy him, and he says 40 days and Nineveh will be overthrown to 30, 40. And God doesn't because they changed their mind. He spares them, and Jonah says, I knew this was going to happen. This is why I left. He has this conversation. I knew that you were merciful and that I was going to be embarrassed. Because here I went through and pronounced those judgments. It's not going to happen. It's the old, is your eye evil because my eye is good. So God is good. And the last thing he wants to do is actually follow through on any of the threats. Who does? Who really does? Who really wants to follow through on those? So, he's got this history of this. Alexander conquers Persia. And then while they're in, like I say, before this, when they get carried off to Babylon, like I say, one of the things the Babylon did was they would go out and pick the best of all the people. That's how Daniel got selected, right? So you would always go through your captive people and you pick the best and brightest, because you're going to turn them into Babylonia people and supporters, so they can argue your case to their people, right? And so Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and a whole bunch of folk were drafted in there, and were trained all the wisdom of the Babylonians and all of this type of stuff. And Daniel has a number of visions. You know, God gives him visions of the future. And a lot of these are to encourage his people that they are going to go back to the land. You know, Daniel is the one who's reading the book of Jeremiah. And Jeremiah is a what we call a pre-exilic prophet, which means he's before the exile. So he's prophesying of doom and says, we're right there at the edge. You don't train up, this is what's going to happen. And then as it's happening, Jeremiah has a prophecy that says, where God says, look, you guys were supposed to be doing the Sabbath rest for the land. It's been 490 years. You haven't given it a single year off. I told you, every 7 years, you're supposed to let the land go fallow. You haven't done any of this, so I'm going to let the land have its Sabbath. So 70 years of Sabbath, and then I'll bring you back. And then you'll work the land again. So Daniel, over in Babylon, see, he's trying to figure out how this happened to us Jews, you know. How did this happen? And he runs across the prophecy of Jeremiah that says 70 years and then you'll be back. And it says this in the book of Daniel. He's reading the Bible in the book of Daniel, and then he prays, and then he prays about to the Lord about, can we move forward? And then God opens up the history of the world up through Rome and the coming of Christ to Daniel. And this passage I've got here is from Daniel 8, and it's about Alexander. So there in the italics, I'm going to read this. In the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, the king, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously. And I looked in the vision, and it came about while I was looking, that I was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam, which is up in about in here somewhere on the map. And I myself was beside the Ulai Canal. Then I lifted my gaze and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in front of the canal. Now the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up fast. I saw the ram butting westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power. But he did as he pleased and magnified himself. While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a conspicuous horn between his head. And he came up to the ram that had the two horns, which had been standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. And I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Okay, we skip a little forward into Daniel. The angel Gabriel interprets this vision to Daniel. The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. And the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. And the broken horn And the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms which will arise from his nation, although not with his power. Okay? So, a couple of hundred years before all of this stuff happens, Daniel has this vision. There's this one animal that's over here in Babylon, and it's got two horns, and a horn always means a king. The animal itself is the kingdom, generally. And so, it's the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. They both had two reigning kings at any given time. That's what the two horns were. Okay, and it was a little dynastic thing. And then the goat that comes from the west is basically Alexander. Alexander smites, conquers Persia. And then he goes all the way to India, by the way. So, he goes all the way to India. He conquers India, actually. He goes that far, and that's when he dies. Well, when he dies, they cut his kingdom into four quadrants. He has four generals. And he cuts the kingdom is divided up between the four generals, none of which is powerful as Alexander, and that's what the reference here is to four kingdoms which will arise, although not with his power. So there's a prophecy of the breaking up of Alexander's kingdom, and we'll talk about two of the kingdoms are going to fight over Israel for the next 50 or 60, 70 years. Okay, and so Alexander... Well, in this process of Alexander coming across, okay, in this country, he actually comes through Israel. And there's a reference, this next quote is from Josephus, who is a 1st century A.D. Jewish historian. He's a Roman. He writes for Rome. He was a general in some of the Jewish wars. He's our best source of history back in those days, and he writes this account of Alexander coming through and meeting the high priests of Jerusalem during this time. Alexander, remember, if you look at that, Alexander conquers Palestine around 332 BC. So it's in that time frame, 300 years before the Lord's born. So there's that next quote, the quote there. And this is Josephus. Now Alexander, when he had taken Gaza, made haste to go to Jerusalem. Now Gaza, remember, is down here, is where it is today, the Gaza Strip, where the Palestinians are right now, down at the border of Egypt, right along here is Gaza. When he had come through Gaza, you wanted to take Gaza because it's seaports. So you had to take Gaza for seaport for control of the war, and that's one of the early things that you would do as a military guy. Now Alexander, when he had taken Gaza, made haste to go up to Jerusalem. And Jaddua, the high priest, when he heard that, was in agony and under terror, not knowing how he should meet the Macedonians, since the king was displeased at his foregoing disobedience. Now, the foregoing disobedience was, I'm the high priest. I'm currently under controlled by the Persians. The Persians are the ones who conquered me last. They're the ones who support me. If I befriend this upstart Greek, guess what's going to happen to me if the Greek loses? He had told him to show up and to meet him, and the high priest had not gone. And so he just knew now that he was going to be in trouble for not going, for his quote unquote foregoing disobedience. Okay? He therefore ordained that the people should make supplication, Jewish people, and should join with him in offering sacrifices to God, whom he besought to protect the nation and to deliver them from the perils that were coming upon them. Whereupon God warned him, the high priest, in a dream, which came upon him after he had offered sacrifice, that he should take courage and adorn the city and open the gates, this is Jerusalem, and that the rest should appear in white garments, but that he and the priest should meet the king in the habits proper to their order. Remember, they had these beautiful robes. The high priest had those, all the 12 beautiful stones and the beautiful turban. If you ever saw that, it was just a magnificent sight. And and the other priest had similar, not the same level of flesh of the high priest, but he was going to have all of Jerusalem dressed in white garments, and he was going to dress up in his habit, without the dread of any ill consequences, which the providence of God would prevent. So the high priest has this dream that says, it's okay, don't worry, I'll take care of you, but follow instructions from me. Maybe you didn't obey Alexander, but follow me, dress like this, have these people do this, open the city, dress it up with garlands and all this kind of stuff. Upon which, when he arose from his sleep, he greatly rejoiced and declared to all the warning he had received from God, according to which dream he acted entirely, and so waited for the coming of the king, Alexander. And when he understood that he was not far from the city, he went out in procession with the king, with the priest, and a multitude of the city. The procession was venerable, and the manner of it different from that of other nations. They reached a place called Salem. For Alexander, when he saw the multitude at a distance, in white garments, while the priest stood clothed with fine linen, and the high priest in purple and scarlet clothing, with his mitre on his head, having the golden plate on which the name of God was engraved, he approached by himself and adored that name. The name of God. That's what Josephus says, that Alexander adored the name of God, and first saluted the high priest. The Jews also did all together with one voice salute Alexander and encompass him about. Whereupon the kings of Syria and the rest were surprised at what Alexander had done and supposed him disordered in his mind. Now, the kings of Syria are Israel's enemies then, as it is now, apparently. Yeah. And they were hoping that Alexander was going to punish Jerusalem, you know, for this. But here he is. He goes up and, you know, makes up with the priest, you know, bows down. And so they figured he's gone insane early. You know, he is a lost. He's gone insane. However, Parmenio alone went up to him of this group and asked him how it came to pass that when all others adored him, he should adore the high priest of the Jews. Remember, this was just backwards. To which Alexander replied, I did not adore him, but that God who hath honored him with that high priesthood. For I saw this very person in a dream, in this very habit, when I was at Dios in Macedonia, who, when I was considering with myself how I might obtain the dominion of Asia, exhorted me to make no delay, but boldly pass over the sea thither, for that he would conduct my army and would give me the dominion over the Persians. Whence it is that having seen no other in that habit, in that costume, in that uniform, and now seeing this person in it, and remembering that vision, and the exhortation which I had in my dream, I believe that I bring this army under divine conduct, and shall therewith conquer Darius, and destroy the power of the Persians, and that all things will succeed according to what is on my mind. See, this was providence. And when he had said this to Parmenio, and had given the high priest his right hand, the priest ran along by him, and he came into the city. And when he went up into the temple, he offered sacrifice to God, according to the high priest's direction, and magnificently treated both the high priest and the priest. Get this next one. And when the book of Daniel was showed him, wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the emperor, the empire of the Persians, he supposed that himself was the person intended. The wording of that. And he was then glad. He dismissed the multitude for the present, but the next day he called them to him and bade the Jews ask what favors they pleased of him. Whereupon the high priest desired that they might enjoy the laws of their forefathers, the Mosaic law, and might pay no tribute on the seventh year, when they were supposed to not be paying, you know, they were supposed to be resting. He granted all that they desired, and when they entreated him that he would permit the Jews in Babylon and Medea to enjoy their own laws also, he willingly promised to do whatever they desired. So they asked for freedom of religion for the Jews in Babylon and Persia when he conquered them. Okay. And when he said to the multitude that if any of them should enlist themselves in his army on this condition, that they should continue under the law of their forefathers and live according to them, he was willing to take them with him. Many were ready to accompany him in his wars. So normally the one thing you didn't allow religious freedom in was in your army. You were so totally dependent upon the gods for your victory, and they were your national gods. They were the gods of Greece. You offered sacrifices to these people, and you believed that every city had its own god, and every nation had its own god. And the Romans, for example, they believed the same thing. The Romans would go into a hostile situation where they were trying to conquer something. And they would try to cut a deal with the deists. They say, we can give you better worship than the local people here. They ain't got any money. We're going to cut off all their money. They're not going to be able to give you the sacrifices that you need to live and survive on. And we'll treat you a whole lot better than they did if you'll just betray them to our God. And then they would circulate that rumor that a deal had been cut. You know, that a negotiation was successful, that they had a contract with the city's gods, and then they would let that leak among the populace that the gods were about to betray the common folk, and so all pandemonium would break out in the city, and so they'd have an ease of conquering them, right? And so here was Alexander, got this divine accompaniment, and gave these great concessions that the Jews could have their laws like they want to. Now, they're used to having this now. And we're going to see that this is part of the problem that's going to have this massive pushback to Jesus when he comes, is about this freedom that gets rescinded later. Okay, so we've got Alexander, he comes through. The next bullet is Palestine under Ptolemaic Egypt control beginning 301 B.C. All right, now that's only 20 years. Only 20 years have passed. Alexander's gone. The four generals, one was Ptolemy, and Ptolemy takes Egypt. Okay, then there's another one who takes Babylon. The other two are insignificant. One takes something far to the north, up high Persia. The other takes Greece and everything. They don't show up in our party. But the Ptolemaic Empire and the Seleucid Empire, these two people are going to fight over this important land bridge, because all the international trade routes go through here. They're going to fight over this for another century. Okay? They get along great for the first 5-10 years. They're old drinking buddies, you know, from the war. You know, but after that, they want this important land bridge, and they're going to start fighting. So, Palestine goes under Egypt in 301. Then, what's that, about 3 years later? 100 years later, it's now, after all these wars, it's now in the control of the Seleucid Empire, which is in Babylon. Palestine changes hands 5 times between those nations in this period of about 100 years. So it's like, who's the president du jour? You know, who's the president today? And so I was thinking about how would I live if I were a commoner, you know, there, and up rides this, you know, military attaché to my little hut, and said, do you support Ptolemy? You know, and so you don't know what the right answer is, whether they're from Ptolemy or from the Seleucids. So you'd say, to the same extent you do, I'm with you. And that's the best you can come up with in terms of an ambiguous response that would get you off the hook, you know. And that's all you can do because you didn't know. As soon as you align with somebody, start supporting them, wham, you know, then you're now a traitor. You're now a traitor. Okay? All right, now, so the Seleucids, the ones over here, control it until we get to this next really bad guy. Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes, starts the persecution in 167-166. And this is also prophesied in Daniel 8, is the prophecy. Out of one of them came another horn, a little one, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. It grew as high as the host of heaven. It threw down to the earth some of the host and some of the stars and trampled on them. Even against the prince of the host, it acted arrogantly. It took the regular burnt offering away from him and overthrew the place of his sanctuary. Okay? Now the commentary right below it explains what this was. Syria, one of the four divisions into which Alexander the Great's empire fragmented, was governed by the Seleucus Nicator, head of the Seleucid dynasty from which Antiochus IV emerged in 175 B.C. He took the title Theos, from which we get the word theology, meaning God, Antiochus Epiphanes, which means illustrious. The Epiphany, of course, is the manifestation. That's a religious season, the Epiphany. And so his title meant Antiochus the Illustrious God. A little bit presumptuous, but others referred to him as Epimenes, the madman. So they made a pun on his name, like you would a politician, you know, today. They made a pun on Epiphanes to Epimenes, which means the madman. In his expansionist policy, he overran Palestine, the beautiful land, and sacked Jerusalem amid terrible bloodshed. He abolished the daily morning and evening sacrificial offerings. Now remember, up to this point, they have complete freedom, right? Alexander gave them complete freedom to do all the law, nothing's wrong. I mean, they're really observant Jews at this point. And all of a sudden, this guy comes in and says he abolished the daily offering, morning and evening sacrificial offering, committed the blasphemy of sacrificing a pig. You just don't do pork in the Old Testament economy. And you don't sacrifice an unclean animal on the altar, a burnt offering. Later placing a statue of Zeus in the temple. That's really bad. Okay. Making human sacrifices on the altar. That's, again, very, very bad. He forbade circumcision and profaned the Sabbath. He also outlawed, under penalty of death, you to read the Torah. You couldn't read your Bible under penalty of death. And so, he was there, he was just trying to change everything that they had as their history. All of their history. And this was where we're going to get a revolt after this to try to reinstate the Mosaic Law. If you fast forward 100 years, the biggest complaint against the followers of Jesus, the Christians, when they go into these cities, was that they're going to change the customs that Moses handed down to us. They really weren't that concerned about Jesus and resurrection. They were concerned that here again, somebody's going to take away our national customs. That was what the big issue for the Jew was in the time of Paul. That they preach another God and they're going to change the customs because they had such a bad experience, you know, in 167 B.C., that it was just, they remember this and have remembered it forever. Okay, so he conquers this. Then we have the Maccabean Revolt against the government. This is a Jewish group, a Jewish priestly family. They're brilliant people. The Maccabean revolt, they actually overthrow this. They get that next bullet, Judean independence under the Maccabees, 152 B.C. and then Israel is a free state again, which it hadn't been, since David and Solomon and those kings back then. They're now a free sovereign state again, and then they're free to develop. And in this next period is when the Pharisees, excuse me, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes, that's where we get Jewish denominations. They pop up during this period. Okay, because then they're all going to argue about, because they all know that they have to be righteous. That when the nation is righteous, there's a promise of a Messiah that's going to come and let them be the world leaders. That eventually that the throne of David is going to be established again. And he's going to reign from all the earth, and nobody's going to pick on him anymore. And so all that Israel thinks that they have to do is to become righteous. And then God will come back, and the son of David will be there, and they'll now be the conquerors of the world. And then what they argue over, like most of the denominations do, is, well, what's the proper definition of becoming righteous? Should you be baptized when you're an infant? Or should you be sprinkled? Or should you be immersed? I mean, everything else doesn't count as righteousness except my way of doing it. And so we have Pharisees that say, man, you got to do it strictly. You have the Essenes that say, yeah, your strictness is not strict enough. You got to leave that unholy city of Jerusalem. It's so polluted. You got to come live out here in the Dead Sea. Write the Dead Sea Scrolls with us. And then the Sadducees, who are just the people in power, they're the liberals of the day. They don't believe in resurrection. They don't believe in angels. You know, they're politically convenient. They're the puppets of Rome in some cases and things like that. But they're a very wealthy elite as well. So the sects developed during this time. The Pharisees were the most popular group with the people generally. They were the most, of the three, they were the least of all evils. Jesus, of course, gets into a lot of controversies with the Pharisees. Pharisees are divided in two or three groups. One of them is a particularly good group, Hillel, which we probably won't get to, actually. But during this time, we have the sectarian writings, the Apocrypha, the Pseudo-Epigrapha, and the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, In the Hebrew Bible goes to in a printed book and would be about two thirds of that size, because most of these like marginal notes, so that'd be the size of the Hebrew Bible as it's written going into this period. So it's about this size during that time frame. There's nothing else that's added to the this particular Bible. So if you buy like a Protestant Bible, it's got just these books in it. Okay. During this time frame, there are three other sets of writings that are written. One is the Apocrypha. So this is roughly be about two thirds of this would be the Apocrypha, because this has also got, you know, little notes at the bottom. Okay. And these appear. Of the books that are in here, some appear in Catholic Bibles, some appear in Greek Bibles, some appear in Slavonic Bibles, some appear in Russian Bibles, and they mix and match which ones. The Jews never put them in their canon, but they said they were still edifying books to read. You know, they said it did not defile the hands. You didn't have to, they were books that were good to read. They weren't heretical. But they didn't defile the hands like the holy books would. Okay? You didn't. There's a cleanness issue. Okay? So we get the Apocrypha written, and it has, for example, the marvelous stories of the Maccabean revolt. So, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Maccabees are four books in the Apocrypha that describe that story of the overthrow of this and the Jewish martyrs and beautiful stories and things of this type in this, okay? And then the Pseudo-Epigrapha is this much material. This is the stuff that the Jewish leaders of their particular sect said, no, this is not good stuff. This is about the subversive element. These are those other people on, you know, that write about this. And this is a massive amount of material. I mean, a massive amount of material that was written by rivals that were arguing over what's the right way to get the Messiah here. What's the right way to get our state back, to get back right with God. There's also a group of literature that I forgot to bring that would be about the size, a little bit larger than that. That's the Dead Sea Scrolls that are written by the Essenes over in the caves around the Dead Sea. Okay, and they're even more strict, and they got code words for when they're slamming the political, the high priest over in Jerusalem. They call him the Wicked One and Son of Belial, and you know, they got all these code words for this guy, but everybody knows exactly who they're talking about. You know, this kind of stuff. So we have lots of literature, and in this literature, massive amounts of messianic prophecy. So we got all these prophecies in the Old Testament about the Messiah that we sing and handle. You know, Isaiah 53, you know, Micah 5:2. We got all these beautiful things that were written. And then all of this literature expands upon this and develops it. And so by the time you get the time that Jesus is about to pop up, you have a messianic fervor. There's lots of people looking for some relief. And had it happened, had he come like during this time where they were in control, might not have been that big a deal. But there's one more event that occurs, and that's on the next page. The Roman conquest, right? Rome takes over, right? So Rome conquers Palestine in 63 B.C. So how long did they have control there? About 100 years. Not quite 100 years. They had the free state, you know, and then Rome conquers them again, and Rome is going to be in control for the longest time. And so now they have a new reason to want a Messiah. They didn't necessarily have one, you know, when they were doing fine, you know, but now that they're in trouble again, you know, now everybody starts getting excited about the Messiah again. Well, the way Rome would when Rome comes through and conquers everything, they're just the most efficient war machine that we had in the ancient world. One of the ways that they would do it, they were smart people. I mean, the Romans were smart, practical people. They didn't have any theories, you know, they didn't have any ideologies, you know, they just wanted to do it the best way. They had the best engineers. They had the best practical things. And so when they went into a country, they didn't want to say, my God is better than your God. You know, they didn't want to have one of these, you know, religious contests. They wanted to say, okay, you pick a leader that you like, and you pay us the taxes. We'll protect you with the Roman army. We'll build a road system second to none. We'll bring money and, you know, trade into you and all this kind of stuff. And so they were smart to always pick a local to run the government, right? Well, at this particular time, there's no local power. See, it's all divided between all these sects and groups and stuff like that. And so there's somebody that rises to the forefront, Herod. And Herod is he marries a Jewish lady. And so he sells himself that way, right? But he's not. He's an Edomite. Hated adversary of the Jew, you know, and so he's going to pretend to be, you know, a very strong supporter of the Jews. So Antipater was the head, but Herod the Great rises, reconquers Palestine with Roman help. There's another fight there. There's a bullet. Somebody else comes from the Parthians, take over. There's another fight there, and he helps the Romans reconquer Palestine. So now he's the persona grata. So Herod the Great takes over. He reconquers Palestine. He's installed. He's this Idumean. He's this Edomite type. You know, the Jews don't like him. And whether the Romans knew that or not, we don't know. But he certainly helped the Romans out in a tough spot, and that's what they gave him was that. And then we come to that last bullet, Jesus' birth occurs during the reign of Herod the Great. Now, you've got the little timeline there that runs from the left to the right. So the blues are the emperors. So 31 B.C. is where Augustus, Caesar Augustus, he's from 31 B.C. to 14 A.D. So Jesus is going to be born between 6 and 4 B.C. Okay, so he's going to be born during the reign of Caesar Augustus. And Augustus is not the guy's name. His name is Octavian. But Augustus means the exalted one, right? So he's going to have a voting. They're going to vote and give him this title like, you know, most holy this and that and the other or whatever, okay? So after Augustus, Tiberius is going to take over. But Tiberius Caesar, and it's going to be under Tiberius Caesar that Jesus is crucified. Okay. Now, Herod the Great, you see, Herod the Great is 37 B.C., the orange, and he's prior to Augustus. So he's got political alliances older than Augustus. So he's got an alliance back right around the Julius Caesar time frame, the period right between Julius and Octavius. Herod the Great is going to be the one that kills all the babies. He's going to be the one that kills the babies in the Jesus story and tries to trick the Magi. And he's going to die. And then his kingdom is going to be divided into a couple different spots. And he's going to have one son there, the top orange, Archelaus, that's going to do Judea, which is the southern part of Israel. You know, Judea, as we talked about, the southern kingdom is basically Judea. Archelaus is very, very bad. He's going to die. He's going to be disposed and die. And then that's going to become a government project. From there on, it's going to have government, like Pontius Pilate, just a pure Roman guy. Okay, that's how we switch from Herod over to Rome, because the guy in between Herod's kid was so bad. He was insane, basically, due to interbreeding, which we'll talk about. I got an org chart of their family coming up here. But up north in Galilee, one of Herod's sons, Herod Antipas, reigns all the way through this time. And he's a smart ruler. He's a good ruler. He's the one that wants to see Jesus do a miracle. He's the one that has John the Baptist beheaded. But he's a good ruler. He does a lot of good things for the Jews. He builds their temple up really good, a lot of political favors. He's really stupid about what he does. He builds his palace on a cemetery. And so the Jews that have to come do business with him, they can't walk in a cemetery. It's unclean. So he always has to come out and meet them outside the city. And they have to compromise. They have to send like go-betweens who are half-Gentile, half-Jew that are not going to be defined. Oh, he's just stupid, you know, from that standpoint. But he builds some beautiful buildings for these people and gives lots of money trying to earn their favor and does a lot of good stuff for that and tries to protect them from Rome. Okay? So that's the historical overview, sort of how we get there. They're currently under the power of Rome. Rome has got, at the time of Jesus, has got Herod the Great over all of it. Okay, Herod the Great is a very politically ambitious. We will see he's extremely brutal. And he's very nervous about the time Jesus is born. This is at the end of his political career. He saved, you know, Rome earlier. But now there have been some issues that he hasn't done with well. He's probably been given notice that, you know, they're starting to make arrangements to change out the rulers. He sees this, and he gets very, very paranoid during this time, as you can imagine. It's going to be playing right into the Christmas story. Okay. So, then we go in our first category is messianic expectations. So I alluded to this earlier. but I've got some source quotes here. Current expectations about the Messiah from the prophecies of Daniel and other prophecies in the Old Testament place the coming of the Messiah in this period, right around the time where Romans in power. Although they were said to refer to the Roman Emperor Vespasian as opposed to the Jewish Messianic figure. We'll see this in a few minutes. Vespasian on our little chart would be after Tiberius. There's several other Roman emperors that occur after Tiberius that are important in Christian history, Jewish Christian history, and one of them is Vespasian, who is the one who conquers in the Jewish revolt. When the Jews finally revolt and get Jerusalem destroyed, the temple destroyed, that's going to be under Vespasian. In that movie Masada, you know, where they take over, that's under Vespasian. He's the emperor at that particular time, okay? And so here's a couple of quotes from Roman historians writing around this period. So the first one's from Tacitus. The majority of the people in Palestine, Syria, in the ancient Near East here, the majority firmly believed that their ancient priestly writings contained the prophecy that this was the very time when the Eastward should grow strong, and that men starting from Judea should possess the world. In other words, they knew, the whole world knew that there was a prophecy that this was about to happen. This mysterious prophecy had in reality pointed to Vespasian and Titus, our emperors, you know. But the common people, the common Jewish people, as is the way of human ambition, interpreted these great destinies in their own favor and could not be turned to the truth even by adversity. In other words, even when the Roman army was just rolling all over them, they still believed that this didn't apply, this prophecy of the world ruler didn't apply to Roman, but it applied to one of their own Jewish buddies. Suetonius, writing a little bit later, there had spread all over the Orient an old and established belief that it was fated at that time for men coming from Judea to rule the world. This prediction, referring to the Emperor of Rome, as afterwards appeared from the event, in which we knew who it was because who won, right? That's what that means. The people of Judea took to themselves. Accordingly, they revolted. So Suetonius blames the Jewish revolt on this messianic prophecy. Okay, and historically, although we won't be able to get into this, everybody was looking for the Messiah, but nobody was expecting a miraculous Messiah until Jesus appears. We have two or three messianic figures before Jesus. And they all, you know, are mostly revolutionary types. You know, this is the time to overthrow Rome. God will be with us. They don't ever promise to do anything fancy. But then Jesus comes and does the feeding of the 5,000. He does all these miracles of healing. And then the next 10 messianic pretenders all promise that if you follow me out into the wilderness, I'll give you food to eat. You know, since they know that Jesus is up the ante. You got up the ante. If you're going to be Messiah, you got to do something like this. How else are you going to beat the Romans? And so the messianic fervor gets worse and worse until the Romans say, "Okay, look, this is enough. I mean, I'm putting a rebellion down every 10 years here, guys. Come on, you know, this last one's really bad. Then we're just going to smoke you out here." So, third one. Now, portents and dreams had come to Vespasian, pointing to the sovereignty long beforehand. And Nero himself, in his dreams, once thought that he had brought the car of Jupiter to Vespasian's house, which meant basically the deity of Vespasian. These portents needed interpretation, but not so the sayings of a Jew named Josephus. He, having earlier been captured by Vespasian and imprisoned, laughed and said, "You may imprison me now, but a year from now, when you have become emperor, you will release me." This was said to be a prophecy by Josephus in correspondence with public Jewish expectation. Josephus, remember, was Jewish, and he was a Jewish military leader fighting the Romans. He was captured by Vespasian when Vespasian was a general, right? And when Vespasian captured, that's when, you know, says, hey, you captured me now, but you're going to be an emperor in a year, and you'll remember this prophecy, which is exactly what happened. He then gets restated to power by Vespasian. And here is Josephus' quote in his passage from the Jewish War. What more than all else incited them, the Jews, to the war was an ambiguous oracle, likewise found in their sacred scriptures, to the effect that at that time, one from their country would become ruler of the world. Now, the key phrase there is at that time. See, most of the messianic prophecies just say someday. They don't say when. See, there's some clues as to when we'll talk about. This they understood to mean someone of their own race, and many of their wise men went astray in their interpretation. The oracle, however, in reality signified the sovereignty of Vespasian, who was proclaimed emperor on Jewish soil. Now, the next two quotes are from the rabbi. Okay, so Josephus is writing after the fall of Jerusalem. And after the crucifixion of Christ and the birth of the church and the separation of the Jewish Christians from the Jewish non-Christians, about 118, 120, 130, up until about that time, the first 100 years of the church, we still went to synagogue. Christians still went to synagogue. We worshipped in synagogue. We said all the Jewish prayers. We did all those things. And because we were converting too many of them, the ruler said, you're really not Judaism. You know, Judaism is changing at this time fiercely because the temple's gone, been destroyed. So they changed the prayers in the 12 benedictions. One of the benedictions says, and cursed be the follower of the Nazarene. Well, what Jewish Christian could do that, because Jesus was known as the Nazarenes. You know, there were the Nazarenes back then in different parts of the country. So pretty hard for them to, you know, you could mumble through that maybe, you know, try to get through. But you really, it would be obvious that that was what it's for. And that was the schism that divided, you know, then we went to house churches through the rest of the period. But up until that point, you know, we were just a denomination within Judaism and still were for a couple more 100 years in different pockets of the world. In Hellenistic and in Judaism, things of this type. But around at that time, after the Jews get driven out of Israel, they get driven up the Galilee, after the Second Jewish War, the 130s, 150s, 160 area, they get driven out, driven out of Palestine, driven out of Jerusalem, the temple is destroyed, the city's rebuilt, named after a foreign god, and they all go up to Galilee, and that's when they write the Jewish literature. That's when they write the Mishnah, the Talmud, all the great Jewish literature. The rabbis are written at this particular point. Well, these are two passages from the rabbis writing around that time. Rav, which is a word for teacher, an exalted word for teacher, said, all times set for redemption have passed, and the matter now depends only on repentance and good deeds. In other words, all the time calculations have been fulfilled. Okay? And then Rabbi Samuel Bar Nahamani said in the name of Rabbi Jonathan, his teacher, basically, blasted be the bones of those who presume to calculate the time of redemption. For they are apt to say, since redemption has not come at the time expected, it will never come. Rather, one must wait for it. What then delays its coming? The measure of justice delays it. In other words, they knew there was a prophecy in Daniel. Daniel's, you know, given all this stuff that says from the going forth from the commandment to restore the temple of Jerusalem So the time of the Messiah shall be X hundred days and weeks. There's this little time period that's given in there. That sits there and says that Israel has the time to do justice. And when they do that, the Messiah will come in and set up this kingdom that will never be destroyed. Okay? And so everybody sort of knows that this is when it's going to happen. It has to be here. And then there's the additional thing that the Messiah was going from the tribe of Judah. And to prove that you were from the tribe of Judah meant you had to have a genealogical record on file somewhere. It had to be notarized, 3 copies, 1 with the DMV. It had to be all these official things. Normally you kept this in the temple. The temple is where you kept all your genealogies since the time of Ezra. When they came back to prove you were a priest from the Levi, you had to be able to show, your family had to produce your, back in the old days, the family Bible that had the genealogy of all the kids' birth and all this stuff. That was a public enough record, right? Birth certificates. You know, they were tablets. You had to be able to prove that you were a descendant of David. You had to be able to prove that you were from Levi to be a priest. Well, when the temple is destroyed, wham, there go all the public records. So how are you going to prove that you're the Messiah from the tribe of David? You still got your local records, right? You hope that you still got your tribal records, but you didn't trust the system. You didn't trust your computer enough to keep it that you destroyed your paper copy. You know, this kind of thing, right? And so we could still prove it. But it's a lot harder. And so when the temple is destroyed, and it's hard to do this, and it's hard for the Messiah to come to his temple. You know, Malachi closes, the Old Testament closes in the Christian Bible, it closes in Malachi. It says, the Lord whom you seek will come, and the messenger will come to his temple. And so the Lord was supposed to show up at the temple. Well, the temple's destroyed. The time of redemption is past. We missed it. And they say, why? They said, because justice wasn't done. Well, we weren't righteous. And we've been trying, the Essenes said, we were arguing among ourselves, we weren't righteous enough when they came. And then, when Jesus comes in, and we won't do this till we do the spring, if we do the Easter session, he'll say, no, the issue is not whether you were righteous enough. The issue is whether you were honest enough about your unrighteousness. Are you honest enough about the righteousness of God and your need for the Savior? That was going to be the issue. Okay? So the time we're right, it's funny when the Pharisees would come to Jesus and say, quit fooling around and tell us, are you the Messiah or not? After he said it 5 or 6 times, that's a separate issue, you know. He says, you know, it's unbelievable. He says, you guys can tell the weather, and you can't see the times here. You know, I mean, you look at the sky, you see it's red, you know it's going to be rain. You know, and you can't see what's happening. When John the Baptist gets thrown in jail, John the Baptist, who knows the Messiah, he baptized the dude, saw the heavens open, the Holy Spirit come down, saw all this happen. Crowds go after Jesus. He gets thrown in jail by Herod and wondering, hey, this isn't working out like I thought. You know, I thought we were going to get, you know, sort of going to be a more triumphal thing than me get thrown in jail. I'm about to be headed. He sends his disciples to Jesus and said, are you the one that was supposed to come or are we supposed to expect another? He knew him. You know, he's just struggling to put it all together. And Jesus says, tell John what you see and hear. That the dead are raised, the blind see, the lame and the poor have the gospel preached to him. And blessed are those, you know, that's the sign of the coming. That's what the great healer was going to be, the great salver of wounds. That was what the measure, and that when Jesus was walking among, nobody had been doing this. Miracles had ceased, prophecies had ceased. They argued, the rabbis argued, when there was going to be another prophet. The prophecy had ceased. They hadn't had a prophet since Jeremiah and Ezekiel types, you know. And he said, look at what's going on here. The kingdom of God's breaking in all around you. see lives change. You see all this stuff happen. Newness occur. Even tax collectors. I'm getting right to God. And you can't, you don't understand what's going on. The time is here. And so the time was ripe. Everybody sort of was waiting for this. And it wasn't precise enough because Jesus has to slip in, quietly here to make this happen. Okay. So now we actually come to the text. So that's all background, and I didn't bring my clock. Where are we?
About 8:45.
All right, the genealogies. Both Matthew and Luke have genealogies. Matthew goes in Hebrew fashion from ancestor forward, the record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and so he goes down from Abraham. While Luke goes in Greco-Roman fashion from child backward. He was the son, so it was thought of Joseph, the son of Heli, the son of Matthew, and he goes backward. Now, we have four Gospels. Only two of them have anything about the infancy narratives, and they're Matthew and Luke. So all the quotes are going to be from Matthew and Luke. Mark doesn't have anything. Mark is basically stories of Peter's preaching. So Mark is really blunt to the point, starts out immediately with John the Baptist. Just boom, he's a person of action. John, the Gospel of John is written in later. When they've tried to figure out what just happened among them. And he starts out with, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. And he starts with this Trinity thing. And it came among us. We'll see this when we come at the very end of the series. We'll say, what difference did this make? What was the point of this? So John doesn't have any birth narratives because for John, they now know that it started much earlier than the birth. It started up in heaven. The sun came down. One guy said one time, he says, when some people think of Christmas, they think of gifts and a baby lying in a manger. And I think the Son of God, I think of the second person of the Trinity standing at the edge of heaven waving goodbye to his Father. They have a different perspective. And they got that as the church sat there and watched this Jesus person walk among them. And they kept having to notch their estimates of who this person was up every day and what he was like until, their categories break. They don't have a way, we don't have a man that's God. How do you put this together? We're not polytheists, And they struggle with this, and the church struggles with it for the first 200 years. But Matthew and Luke have genealogies. Next bullet, at least partial genealogical records of important, especially priestly families, were kept in the temple. After the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, anyone could have claimed to be of Davidic descent, but the claim for Jesus was made before 70, when it could still have been checked. Even after 70, the evidence for his Davidic descent was still sufficient to provoke trouble for some of Jesus's relatives with the Roman government. After the Christians become a growing problem for the Roman administration and the empire, they said, okay, so this was a Davidic king, a Jewish king. Where is his family? I mean, we're scared there may be another one that cranks up, so let's go try to deal with his family. So they go find some of the relatives of Jesus, bring them to Rome, and the little relatives, hey, we're shepherds, dude. We have no political pretensions at all. We're shepherds. We have 39 acres of land over here. Look at us. We're no threat to you. So you could still do it a little bit, but most of the time, like I say, it was done under the messianic prophecy of David. Now, the prophecy of the Messiah, the messianic prophecies, the one that everybody was sort of looking for was the Son of David one. The prophecy that the Messiah would be prophet, priest, and king. The kingly one was the prophecy to David in Samuel. He says to David, he said, I will create a dynasty out of your house, and I will take one of your sons that will be on your throne, and he will rule on your throne forever and ever, an eternal reign. Not that just the dynasty would continue, but that one of your sons that comes from your body will sit upon the throne of Israel forever and ever and ever. There were also prophecies of a king that would, of a priest and the prophets that would minister for the people and things of this type, a high priest forever. So there are prophecies, but the one that was mostly associated at this time was the prophecy of being the son of David. So Jesus being the son of David was important to be proven. Okay, third. Women did not need to be recorded in ancient genealogies, but Matthew includes four women in his. Okay? Three of them were Gentile women, and the other also a Gentile, or at least the wife of a Gentile. Even though he omits the matriarchs prominent in Jewish tradition, you know, Sarah, the famous people, the famous matriarchs, he hints from the Old Testament that God had always planned missions to all peoples, being the Gentiles. This is one of the big arguments that's going to occur in the book of Acts, is that, hey, yeah, Jesus rose from the dead and all this goodness, but it's only for us Jews, not for those broken down Gentiles. You know, they don't deserve it. They're scum. You know. It's heresy to think that God would bless the other people to this big point. Not, I'm overstating it considerably here because they prayed for the nations. And we'll see, for the first 20 years, there's no such thing as a Gentile Christian. We're all Jewish Christians. So when I say that, you know, the Jews didn't like the Gentiles, it's only some of them to begin with. And a lot of that changed over time. And there's only actually a small minority of those that were in Jerusalem, generally. That's a separate issue. Okay, so he admits the matriarchs, but he still has these Gentile women. Matthew omits some names, as was customary in genealogies, in this case perhaps following the Greek translation of the Old Testament, creating patterns like three sets of 14 made lists easier to remember. In other words, Matthew has three sets of 14 names. Abraham to David, David to somebody, somebody to Jesus. And he missed a whole bunch of names just to make it come out 14, 14, 14. Because when you said so-and-so was the son of so-and-so, son could mean as far as great-grandson and still work with the language. And we have that in one of the priests where the son, so-and-so was the son of so-and-so, and this is the great-grandson. So you could put gaps, and it was just easy to remember 14 because Matthew was probably one of our earliest catechism books. So when you would go to a Bible study, you would open Matthew and you'd memorize the genealogy because it was easy to memorize his than Luke's. And Luke is writing for a Roman, Greco-Roman group. And so you will see so much more emphasis in Luke on Rome and women. Every time there's a parable about a man, there's a parable about a woman. Luke is a physician. Luke has so much more interest in the nativity stories. You know, he's more interested. We think there's church history tradition as late as the 4th century that said Mary was the ghostwriter for part of Luke's gospel. And that's why she had such insight to what happened around the Nativity. And that was the source of information for Luke's gospel. Because Mary, of course, was a disciple that followed with the Lord, you know, in her time frame as well. Another interesting fact about Matthew's genealogy is the inclusion of four Old Testament women: Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Solomon's mother, Bathsheba. All of these women, as well as most of the men, were questionable in some way. Everybody, we've got this genealogy of Matthew. had done something wrong, and we got written down. You know, they got police records, you know, something of this type, you know. Tamar and Rahab were prostitutes. Ruth was a foreigner, a Moabitess. And Bathsheba committed adultery with David. Right? Matthew may have included these women in order to emphasize that God's choices in dealing with people are all of His grace. Perhaps also he included these women in order to put Jewish pride in its place. Right? Because the Jewish pride of the day would say, yeah, God picked us because we're better than everybody else. You know, and Paul is going to have this problem himself and deal with this. Actually, apparently not. You know, I mean, here was some resign, came through these questionable people. And actually in all of these, with the except, well, Tamar and Bathsheba, of course, their sin that's recorded in Scripture was at the instigation of a Jewish male. So, of course, David and Bathsheba, remember, he's the one who ordered her over. He saw her bathing. He sent his, you know, in public, sent public servants over to get, you know. So everybody knows this. Tamar, when we say it's a prostitute, Tamar was a daughter-in-law of Judah, of the 12 tribes, right? And Tamar, there's a law. Tamar has, she's a son, daughter-in-law, and when the son-in-law died early because of some wickedness, under the law back in those days to try to keep the family alive, you married a brother. The brother took the wife, the widow, as his wife, even if it was a second wife, so that the kid from them would inherit the property of the brother, the deceased brother. Well, after two of them were killed, there's only one son left, because they got killed for their own bad reasons. Okay, there's only one son left, and Judah says, I don't think I want to give this guy to her because he's going to die. He doesn't see any fault in his sons, obviously. It's actually Tamar's fault. And so he sends Tamar away to her parents. That's where the widow would go back and live with the parents. And Tamar was non-Jewish, so she went back to a Canaanite family, and Judah lied and said, wait for Shimei to grow up, because Shimei is only about 8 or 10 at the time, and then we'll finish this deal. He never has no intentions of this. And then, so Judah sees, Tamar sees that this is not happening, she does this ruse where she dresses up like a shrine prostitute, and he's going to do some business. He says, hey, why not? You know, we don't have the Mosaic law yet, I guess, maybe. Whatever, you know. So he goes into the shrine prostitute, and she gets the ring, and there's this little subtlety. She gets pregnant by him, and that's the descendant of Jesus. That's the progenitor of Jesus. And then when he finds out that she's pregnant, he wants to kill her in self-righteousness, you know, that she's been obviously playing the harlot. You know, and so he's call her out and let's burn her to death. You know, and she sends, she had asked, when are you going to pay me my prostitute fee? It was a religious prostitute, not just a regular prostitute. And he said, well, I don't have a goat. He said, well, give me your ring as a safeguard. I'll return it to you, you know, when you send me the goat. And she keeps the ring, and so she says, I'm pregnant by the man who owns this ring and the staff. And he says, this is my staff. And he makes a statement, she is more righteous than I am because I did not follow through on that promise. So even her, quote-unquote, indiscretion here was at the provocation of a failed Jewish male in this particular case. So Jewish pride there against the leaders. All right, so that's the genealogies, and we didn't read those, but all the other passages we'll actually read. Galilee, Nazareth, and Bethlehem. Now here we have a map, and if you want to take out the map, the map was in your inside cover. You'll see sort of where the materials are. Actually, I may not even need to draw it here, but the print's a little small here. But let me draw one thing here on this. In the land, in the Mediterranean Sea, the land of Israel. If down here is Gaza, we have the Dead Sea. And then the Sea of Galilee. So the Sea of Galilee, you'll see in the diagram there, is up in that top part here, that top map, is the Sea of Galilee. There's the River Jordan that connects the Dead Sea down here, which is by, this will be Jerusalem, will be here by the Dead Sea. Cana, where Jesus does the wedding. You know, turns the wine into the water into wine is up in Cana. Nazareth is right here, and Capernaum, where his family moves for his ministry, is right there on the Sea of Galilee. Okay, this distance from the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea is about 60-70 miles. So you can, you know, visualize where that is, Greenville to Greenwood to the hills. Jerusalem is about 15 miles here. Bethlehem is going to be right here, going to be, you know, 6 to 8 to 10 miles south of Jerusalem. Nazareth is going to be up here, you know, all of these are going to be within, you know, 5 to 10 miles of one another. It's a very small area. From the Dead Sea over to here, this distance is about 50 to 60 miles. So it's a very small little area that all of biblical history occurs in. There is this horribly reputation to place in between here. This is Galilee, the province, however you spell Galilee. This is Samaria, and this is Judea. Okay, so this is Judea. Samaria is basically what's left of the northern kingdom. Remember when the northern kingdom gets hauled off? Its capital was Samaria. That's where Ahab and Jezebel, they had the city of Samaria. They live here. They're hated by the Jews because they're half-breeds. They're totally half-breeds. The Galileans are despised too. We'll see that in a minute. But they're not half-breeds per se, but Herod sets up all his major cities up here, big famous cities here. Up in here, building areas. When they had the city that's built on the cemetery is up here in Galilee. Herod rules from Galilee. Jews generally, when they traveled between Galilee and Jerusalem, they would cross the River Jordan. And then go on this side of the River Jordan so they wouldn't have to go through Samaria. It was that much religious prejudice against these people. And so it was just, the disciples were just so amazed in John 4 when Jesus said, we've got to go through Samaria. There's a woman at the well I need to talk to. There's a city there that needs me. And so I'm going to forget what these people are going to say. They don't like me anyway. I know where this is going. So I'm going to go ahead. And so normally you would go across and go down. Most Jews would. And it's not just out of prejudice. The prejudice ran both directions. So you didn't have a place. So one time Jesus sent, you know, James and John into Samaria to prepare a place because he was going to go preach in there. And they rejected them and said, no, we're not going to let you stay in our place, our towns. We don't like you. You're Jews. And so it was two ways. It was dangerous to go that way as well as just, you know, something you wouldn't necessarily relish per se. So the first sites that we're going to talk about, almost the most of Jesus' ministry is up here in Galilee. The early ministry is up here in Galilee, All his disciples are Galileans. He's known as the Galilean. He will make these trips down to Jerusalem to minister and then go back. He'll go back. When we get the new church in the book of Acts, the apostles will be ministering out of here. They'll have Jerusalem as the center. But Jesus' family, his brothers, most of them will go back to Galilee and do the Galilean church, which we'll talk about. Okay? So now let's look at what Galilee and them were like. And that's as far as we'll probably get tonight. In the sixth month, and this is from Luke, in the sixth month, God sent the angel Gabriel to Nazareth, a town in Galilee. So there's Nazareth down at the bottom there, here at the border of Samaria, to a virgin pledged to be married to a man named Joseph, a descendant of David. The virgin's name was Mary. In those days, that's Luke, in those days Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. And everyone went to his own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee. So he lived there, same place where Mary did, obviously, to Bethlehem in because he belonged to the house and line of David. Bethlehem, of course, was where David's family was born, grew up. They owned the country there, Bethlehem, in the Old Testament. Okay. Galilee, taken from the Hebrew Galil, ring or circle, hence a district. This is the regional name of the northern part, a part of North Palestine, which was the scene of Christ's boyhood and early ministry. The origin of the name, as applied here, is uncertain. It occurs occasionally in the Old Testament, and notably in Isaiah 9:1. The latter reference probably recalls the region's history. It originally formed part of the lands allocated to the 12 tribes, but owing to the pressure from peoples farther north, its Jewish population found themselves in a kind of insalient, I did some spell check there, apparently, surrounded on three sides by non-Jewish populations, the nations. Under the Maccabees, the Gentile influence upon the Jews became so strong that the latter were actually withdrawn south for half a century. Thus, Galilee had to be recolonized, and this fact, together with its diversity of population, contributed to the contempt felt for the Galileans by the southern Jews, John 7:52. So, you know, that's... They make slurs on Galilee all the time because it's got a mixed population. It hadn't been strongly Jewish for very long. It's surrounded by Gentiles. And so it's looked down upon by the good Jews of the South. Okay? Nazareth in this period, this town, was an insignificant village of an estimated 1,600 to 2,000 inhabitants. So think of a city, 1,600 to the Shaw. Charles, something like that size, roughly, isn't it? Something like that. That's about that size. Wouldn't have a lot of central buildings. It would have been spread out. Nazareth, importantly, however, was only about 4 to 6, maybe 10 miles from one of these major metropolitan areas that Herod built, Sepphoris. Big, big city. And they would have needed a constant supply of carpenters. Constant supply of goods and services from the surrounding populace. And that's where we think Jesus learned some of the Greek terminology that he uses in the Gospels. When he talks about the hypocrites, when he uses the word hypocrites, that's a Greek dramatic term. That's a term from Greek drama. And the only way that's hypocrite was the face that you wore on the stick. You know, two-faced is what hypocrite meant. And it was a theatrical term. And they would have had Greek theater in Sepphoris. And, you know, conceivably Jesus could have worked on the theater and seen some of that, you know, and he's building it out and knowing enough about it. There's enough Greek culture that came through that to where that phrase would have been a very apropos one to use. The fact that the family moved to Nazareth was once again said to be a fulfillment of prophecy. Okay, now this is, remember the story briefly. They're in Nazareth. They get the decree to do Caesar Augustus. They've got to go register. So they're going to go down here to Bethlehem and register. There's going to be all the events that we'll study in subsequent sessions. But they're going to go back and settle in Nazareth. Instead of going back to his where he owns land, Bethlehem, they become afraid because that insane guy is the governor now. He's been, not elected, but had been appointed governor by the death of his father. And he's insane. They're scared to death. And an angel warns Joseph, returning from Egypt, don't go back here, even though you got land there. Go back to, up to Nazareth where you were working. And so that's what this is referring to. And we'll look at all that detail as we get into the session. But I did want to explain that phrase. The fact that the family moved to Nazareth was once again said to be a fulfillment of prophecy in Matthew. However, the words, he will be called a Nazarene, were not directly spoken by any Old Testament prophet, though several prophecies came close to this expression. Isaiah said the Messiah would be from Jesse's roots like a branch. Branch is the Hebrew word netzer, which has the same consonants like that in the word Nazarene, and which carries the idea of having an insignificant beginning. Since Matthew used the plural prophets, as it says in the prophets, he shall be called a Nazarene, perhaps the idea was not based on a specific prophecy, but on the idea that appeared in a number of prophecies concerning the Messiah's despised character. Remember Isaiah 53, he was despised of men, right? I mean, we get a lot of despised, rejected Messiah prophecies. Nazareth was the town which housed the Roman garrison for the northern regions of Galilee. Therefore, most Jews would not have had any associations with that city. In fact, those who lived in Nazareth were thought of as compromisers who consorted with the enemy, the Romans. Therefore, to call one a Nazarene was to use a term of contempt. So because Joseph and his family settled in Nazareth, the Messiah was later despised and considered contemptible in the eyes of many in Israel. This was Nathanael's reaction when he heard Jesus was from Nazareth, in John 1:46, can anything good come from Nazareth? Remember, one of Jesus' early disciples runs to tell Nazareth, we have found the Messiah. He is Jesus from Nazareth. And Nathanael knows better. He knows better. He says, can anything good come from Nazareth? He says, come and see. This concept fits several Old Testament prophecies that speak of the lowly character of the Messiah. Archaeological evidence in the region of Nazareth indicates that many people had moved there from Judea from the area near Bethlehem. So this makes sense why we would have a Bethlehemite up in Nazareth, because there was this mass movement up there. And there are two or three reasons why that's possibly the case. One, of course, is the building activity up there. There were jobs up there around Nazareth. But more importantly, in my opinion, is Herod, who was always paranoid, kept building fortresses. He built this Masada. He had all these different places. And he built one of his monolithic, paganish-y mounds, Herodium, right outside of Bethlehem. So it's like, you know, there goes the neighborhood. Here's Herod. Moves in. So maybe he's going to conscript us in his army. He's dangerous to be around. There's jobs up here in Nazareth. Let's go up there. Galilee's a little off the political radar. But the archaeology indicates that there were a number of people that moved up there from Bethlehem. Joseph may have had friends or relatives in Nazareth, or of course he might have moved with his family. Nazareth was on a major road from the coast of Syria, and only a few miles from the culturally diverse city of Sepphoris, which was being rebuilt at this town. Though small, Nazareth would not have been isolated from the broader cultural currents of antiquity. It would have seen what was going on in the world. Pottery samples suggest a recent migration of people from the Bethlehem area to Nazareth around this time. Joseph's legal residence is apparently still Bethlehem, where he had been raised. He apparently still owns land there. Now, Micah 5:2 is one of these prophecies in the Old Testament. It predicted Bethlehem as the Messiah's birthplace because the Messiah was to be a descendant of David, and Bethlehem had been David's hometown. It was a small town, less than a 10-mile walk from Herod's capital, Jerusalem. The Magi had come to Jerusalem because that was where they expected to find any Judean king, perhaps one of Herod's own sons. What is remarkable is that the scribes would know where the Messiah would be born, yet not act on that knowledge, either positively or negatively. So let me close with this, what that's referring to. Remember, when the Magi come, they're coming to find the king of Israel, the king who was born in the east. Well, the logical place you would go to find the king would be in the capital, right? They know who the king is. It's Herod. Maybe they think it could be one of Herod's sons that's going to be this king. They don't know who the identity is. And that's why instead of going straight to Bethlehem, they go straight to Herod first. That's a logical choice. So they go there to Jerusalem, and they say, where is he who was born the king of the Jews? And Herod, of course, is upset about this. So he turns to the little scholars and says, where is the Messiah supposed to be born? Well, the scholars know it's supposed to be in Bethlehem. And they quote Micah 5:2, Bethlehem, you the least among the nations, from you will come here and be the ruler of my people Israel. Right? Messianic prophet. They know that, but does anybody get up and go? No. They just sit there and it's just academic knowledge to them. They know their Bible. They don't do anything about it when the Magi say, hey, it's time. We have come. The sign is here. Aren't you interested? Well, maybe they weren't interested while they were standing there in Herod's presence. Right? And it might have been politically inexpedient to say, yeah, let's go find the guy that's going to replace this jerk. I could see that would be a CLM, a career-limiting move, to say the least. Probably a life-limiting move. But they knew where this was supposed to happen, and they knew sort of when this was supposed to happen. And here's this outside scene that's going to happen that we won't study probably until the third session that we're into, where we see the significance. Because the Magi, because the star led them. The star could have led them straight to Bethlehem. Because it does after this event. The star led them to Jerusalem and woke the world up. Woke the world up. And boy, things start in motion here. Because, well, I'll say, we've got Messiahs already. We've got John the Baptist. Well, not John the Baptist at this particular point. We've got those prophecies of the Messiah coming. Everybody's sort of knowing that this is supposed to happen. Herod's terrified of it. And there are a number of things in this that they interpret really, really negatively for Herod, and that's why he's going to have a problem with Jesus early on. Okay? So what we covered, basically, I guess we got through just most of the background material, genealogies, a little bit of the background. Next time we'll get into actually the Joseph and Mary story, and the Annunciation by the angel and the beautiful, her responses, and how unprecedented it was. The fact that God came this way is amazing. We'll come at the end where we talk about why this way. Why was it so quiet? Why was a little baby in a manger? Why didn't he shine in the dark? Why didn't he do the things other famous people did when they were little babies? Caesar Augustus ordered, he was an infant, he couldn't sleep because of all the frogs, and he told all the frogs to be quiet, and they were all quiet. And You know, Jesus doesn't do any of these little things. You know, he's one of us. And so there's a difference between the manifestations of God and the incarnation. Manifestations are God in a form. The incarnation is God in flesh. One's temporary, one's impressive. God in a storm, Sinai. That's impressive. But just a Jewish carpenter from Nazareth, Galilee, very unimpressive until he touches your heart. Then you say, oh, there's something hiding behind or inside this Nazarene. Something's going on here. Maybe God has answered his prayers. His promises of the Messiah that walks among us. Maybe it just wasn't like the one we were expecting to overthrow the Rome. So, let's close in a word of prayer and we'll just resume from there next time. Lord, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the beauty of your intersection into our lives, the sweetness of your care for us. We thank you for your kindness that broke into history in the person of your Son. We thank you for the fact that you came among us. You didn't come among us as this lordly, kingly figure that would be unapproachable to most of us. But you came as one of us. You were touchable. We could sit down and have a meal with you, as so many did. And you would minister to us. And we just would ask that through this Christmas season that we would recognize more and more that grace, and then our lives would open up more and more to that gentleness and to that beauty. So bless these hearts, Lord, as they look at this, and all of us as we look at this, the Christmas season, Lord, that you speak afresh to us of the amazing story that occurred here, the unusual, without precedent, without follow, sequel. Story of you coming and walking among us. And we beheld his glory as of the glory as of the only begotten Son of God. So thank you for this time, and we ask for you to bless our season and our study here the next couple of times. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.